I actually watched an episode about the Transformers.
Cool. I
So
actually watched
there's
one on
that.
Barbie, which was interesting.
The Barbie one was good. I had no idea there was the scandal involved.
Yeah, it is kind of fun. It's even like with Kenner, I had no idea they were such a rinky-dink company, and Star Wars put them on the map.
Well, we'll be talking about the Transformers one because there was a lot in there that I didn't know.
Well, let me watch it first, and maybe we could use that for as a review episode next week.
Did you know that they basically just came to Marvel and said, "We don't have names for any of these toys. You think them up."
I didn't know that. I do know that the original Transformers, which is why they look so weird and different scales, they kind of just went around and bought all these different molds from different companies, including one from Macross, which is why Skyfire looks like a big Macross figure.
There's a Micronauts tie-in as well.
Yeah, because they use the same. Well, if it's what I think it is, they use some of that, like in. God, they had this Omega Supreme that, if you repainted, looked like a Micronaut.
Yeah.
It was the same type of thing. It had the little wind-up battery-operated thing that would go along the tracks, and it was very Micronaut-ish. But even that, they bought, like, even we were at Radio Shack, and one of the transforming guns, not Megatron, but Shockwave. And we're looking at this toy that Radio Shack has, because that looks a lot like Shockwave. And for it was almost exactly, except for the color. And what we didn't realize is that, well, yeah, these were like the remnants of the original toy line that I forget the name of the company that was doing the Transformers. They just said, "We want to buy this mold." And they're like, "Okay, go ahead, take it," because it wasn't selling worth shit. So for a while there, you're getting all these knockoffs that looked a lot like the original Transformers coming to the United States under different names, and essentially they were just blowing out the old toys trying to cover it. But I didn't know about the name thing, because I thought the what came first, the cartoon or the comic?
The comic came first. And when you watch it, Transformers came about because of G.I. Joe. The
That I can believe.
original G.I. Joe, the 12-inch one.
Oh, really?
We'll talk a little about it because I did not. First, Shooter went to Denny O'Neil and had him create names and backstories for the characters, and Denny just kind of they dance around it, but it's really clear that Denny just kind of was like, "I don't fucking care," and did a half-ass job. So Shooter took it down the hall to Bob Budansky, who was an artist editor, the only artist editor, and he talked about it a little more online. He was basically, it's like, "Oh shit, this is the way, if I do this, they can't fire me."
What I found interesting, and I don't know if you ever read the comic
By the way,
because it was such.
we're wasting valuable podcast news.
But yeah, you can just throw that in and say, "Hey, this is the beginning," and then play the music like now.
Hello and welcome once again to Crazy Comics and Stories. It's me, your charming and delightful old Uncle Rat Bastard. And as you've no you could tell from the early part of the episode that at the other end of
Corey,
this
talk Transformers. Where's Adam? Where's Dan? I need them here to listen to this historical occasion.
But if you notice, I didn't talk about the toys at all. It was all about Marvel being involved in it. So that stuff fascinates me. And actually, if you watch that episode of The Toys That Made Us, they really go into the creation of the Transformers. And the Japanese designer who kind of created the whole idea And I guess when he left, it was kind of a big deal. And the toys kind of fell apart. And then when he came back, he brought them back to life.
That's interesting, because I hadn't heard that of the history of the toys. Although, like we were gabbing earlier, I'd heard about where they had gathered various molds together from different companies that made transforming toys and kind of pushed them together. And it went on even to this day, because they did end up buying the aforementioned GoBots, if you remember that line, which was a really poor knockoff of Transformers. But eventually, Hasbro just bought the whole molds and the line from them to just keep the toys going. What I found interesting, though, to kind of swing us back to comics, I don't know, did you ever read that first issue?
I did not.
Because I know I picked it up because, you know, I don't remember. When did that come out originally?
84.
84. Okay, so that would be in college, because my buddies in college, we really got into collecting the toys because they were just so damn intricate. I remember working Sears catalog, and I've said this story where Ama came up with a toy, and I believe it was Megatron. Said, this doesn't work, and I looked over as a kid, and I said, hey, come over here. Transform this, and again, flip, 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 flip. It's in the gun mode. Flip it back. Robot. I said, it's fine. It's just, we're not going to be able to do it.
Yeah.
And they were, I mean, the first run in the catalog sold out almost instantly because it was that hot. And I was thinking, well, I'll order this Optimus Prime. Nope, out of stock. Everything was out of stock. There's even a story where one of the Transformers was named Devastator. It's like six construction vehicles that form a big one. And they had one of these sets, which I guess was a Sears exclusive at the time, where you got the entire characters in one big box. Now, what Sears did with certain things is the toys would come in, and if somebody returned them or they didn't pick them up, which was a big, big problem with Sears catalog. Not so much a problem with Amazon, if you notice, but I mean, they would either not pick up the stuff after they ordered it. They didn't want to pay shipping charges, even though, you know, technically this stuff was being shipped to the store. You'd have people ordering like four different sizes, returning three because they didn't know what would fit, which was one of the conundrums Sears had. I don't know if Amazon has that problem or not. But certain stuff they wouldn't return back to the warehouse. They would just send downstairs to the department. They had to deal with it. Tools were one of them, and toys were one of them. I remember this big Constructicon set coming back. And while I probably could have just said, hey, guys, I'll just buy this outright, the way you did it is you took it off the inventory, you transferred it to the store department, then you bought it from the store. So I waited, it went downstairs, and I never saw it again. Until I saw it in Brian's shop, the original Hot Comics, a little tiny 100-foot shop. Somehow that SOB got to that thing before I did, which is amazing because, I mean, I remember at the beginning of the shift, it went downstairs. At the end of the shift, I went downstairs and it wasn't there. And, you know, I knew all the hiding spots, so I went looking for it. I'm like, huh, that's weird. Even then, he was beating me out on the crucial toys. And, boy, I wish I had a few of them suckers now because they are really pricey. Because not only were they originally a Sears thing, but now, you know, any of those original Transformers are just crazy, crazy money. Even the collection that my buddies and I put together, they brought it to Hot Comics eventually, and, man, we just liquidated them. Even loose, they were crazy. One of my favorites was something called Predaking, which were like five beasts, and you put it together, and it was like this giant lion robot, and I had it on top of the bookshelf, and people were like, what is that? Because it was big enough where it would stand by itself. Whereas some of those Transformers were so thin, like Megatron and Devastator, you had to prop them against something. Otherwise, they'd flop over on themselves. And what's old is new again, because they're still selling them toys. And they go back every so often and bring back the original molds, at least the ones they can legally do. And, you know, here's a commemorative edition, Optimus Prime, for $200. Ooh, gotta give me one, gotta give me one. It's like shooting fish in a barrel. But the whole comic thing was, is that first issue when they had all the toys there. Well, they basically were, whoever was drawing it was drawing basically the toys, and they looked nothing like their comic book counterpart. It wasn't until later, and you answered the question, where the comic came out first and then the show came out, because then people would start making it more like their comic book part, not so much the toy. So you had like the Medic Ratchet, which was a van that when it opened up looked like a medical bed with a head at the base of it, or the head of it, whatever. It had nothing to do with anything on the TV show. There he looked like, you know, an anthropomorphic robot, and then, you know, he'd turn into the medic van or whatever. So they must have used toys as guidelines in the beginning, at least till the show came out. And then, of course, you always had the problem. 12 issues. They only do 12 issues a year, and it took so long for the story to go. In the meantime, they cranked through two seasons in a movie where they killed off half the characters. And by the time they got around to killing off Optimus Prime in the comic, they already had him back. So they were always running behind, and they were trying to catch up. And there were wads of issues where they would just introduce new characters. Like they had this thing called Headmasters, where it was essentially a human, but, an alien. They'd transform into the head, and then you'd pop it into the robot, and that's how it existed. And by the time they introduced the Headmasters, they already finished that line. They were on a different line. And so the comic was always, always behind, at least with Marvel, trying to catch up. With IDW, I don't think they bothered. They just said, you know, we're just using these characters. It has no conceivable tie-in to the toy line or whatever's going on. They're just using the classic ones. And I guess, judging by what's coming up, they've made it just one vast universe, not only with the Hasbro toys, but in and of itself, because they're coming up to like their big finale, you know. And no, it's not a finale because it's going to keep going, but that's at the Unicron miniseries that I think just solicited in the preview, so it should be out next month. Lest I continue talking, you know, I might just take over this here podcast. Between last episode and this one, I'm getting a lot of mileage out of this. Now you see the fun. I just sit back. It's like I put a quarter in Corey. I sit back. I'm off downloading hardcore porn or something. But Corey actually had a topic that we were going to talk about.
Yes, I have a topic.
But before we do that, I...
We're both
trying to... We're trying to talk first. Hold on, me first. You first. You go. Okay, you first.
All right. By the time the episode drops, this is old news. But I
would, very true.
And it's probably, and some people will say, well, that's not related to comics.
Well, neither was what I was saying last episode, but just deal with it. If you don't like it, make your own podcast.
Well, it is connected with comics, because I will draw the line and use a couple examples. This morning, Roseanne Barr tweeted out something comparing a black woman to an ape. Within hours, ABC canceled her top-rated sitcom. And I don't mean, you know, it was, well, you know, we're thinking about it. Nope, this show is canceled. They had already given it a renewal and, two seasons, I think. And it's, nope, they're done. Plug was pulled. And if you think this was, it's something where, well, you know, they're not. No, they're in production. There are hundreds of people working on this show because, you know, for the fall TV shows, these shows are already in production. So everybody working on that show is not going to be able to get on with some other TV show. And I'm not going to get into anything other than this shows that Disney is big enough that they do not have to put up with your shit. If they're able to cancel their number one show that they were using to anchor a Tuesday night and cancel it like that, I would like to remind certain comic creators, if Disney would do that to a show that big, that generates that much money, Do you think they will tolerate your petty-ass bullshit? And I'm pointing to the artist over on the X-Men who put in anti-Jewish stuff in the background in a foreign language. The minute it was discovered, he was gone. Vapors. History. He's not going to be able to get a job at American Comics unless, you know, it's some piddly-ass publisher who doesn't know anything. There's an artist over at DC who has been pain in the ass on the internets. His contract was up, and as they were coming up to renegotiate the contract, DC wouldn't even talk to him. His contract's up, he's gone. Marvel, they're not touching him either. If you make racist comments, if you make jokes about 9/11, if you say things about any group of people, Disney and Time Warner do not care about you. So if you're working for Disney, you don't want to make any waves. If you're working for Time Warner, you don't want to make any waves if you want to continue to work. And one of the things, oh, well, I'll do indie stuff and I'll sell my stuff to Hollywood. Hollywood does their due diligence. They're going to look back and go, oh, look at this stuff he said in public forums. Yeah, we don't want that trouble. We don't want to deal with that coming out. These are multinational companies. They are selling stuff to Europe. They're selling stuff to China. They're selling stuff to Africa. They're selling stuff to South America. If you have stuff where some gossip column can say, did you know that a person working for thus and such production studio said this? They don't want that. They do vetting. Roseanne Barr was able to get away with that shit in the 90s because TV was different. And ABC was not owned by Disney. If Disney is able to kill their number one show in a couple of hours from one tweet, I'm not saying that, you know, they're cracking down on freedom of speech. I'm saying that as a corporation, they just don't have the time to deal with it. If you say racist stuff, if you say stupid stuff, if you say anything that's going to cause negative press, you're going to be gone. Let's grow up. If you're a comic professional, the second word in that is professional. It's time for us to be professional. I said a couple of years ago, the Eye of Sauron is on comics now. People who've been misbehaving in the past are gone. So I just want to throw that out there for people who maybe, I'll just say something. Well, it's a joke. Somebody catches me, I'll just say it's a joke. It's not going to work anymore. You want to keep your job? Don't be an idiot. I told you not to be stupid, you moron.
Because just like we're talking about the Sword Pass, something came to my attention. Mr. Strode.
Oh, God, what did I do now?
Tell me about Wen at WIU.
Oh, WHEN.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did radio at WHEN. And then my name on that station was Solitaire Rose. I've been doing it for that long.
What about the Cinema Showcase?
I was worked on that. Almost was elected the leader, but my grades weren't good enough.
And what's this about you doing Rocky Horror Picture Show?
Oh, yeah, I was the host for the Rocky Horror Picture Show whenever we would run it. Most of the job of the host was, please don't throw anything at the screen. Now, when we started, we would just be down in this little 100-seat theater. But with the work that I did to promote it, my last year at Western Illinois University, we were up in the ballroom with over 1,000 seats, selling it out every year.
I thought maybe you would be like more like Dr. Frankenfurter with the full getup.
Oh, no, I was the host.
Maybe you should be that. Maybe you should have been that way.
Nah.
Hey, you know, women like guys in lingerie.
If I was going to do any of that, I probably would have been the narrator.
With no neck?
Yes.
It's astounding. I'd rather be Riff Raff.
But,
like you're on the station!
Now, the first year at WHEN, which was my first radio gig, it was, I had to play Top 40. And then the second semester, they were like, okay, you can make it a specialty show and play the kind of music you want. And the problem was, for them, I was the only person getting phone calls. So we would go off on tangents with the callers, and they finally, they put their foot down. You have to play 5 songs an hour. And we would get near the end of the hour. It's like, oh, crap, we've only played 3 songs. So I would play 2 songs at the same time. At one point, we did it. I had a list of songs that were a lot like each other, like He's So Fine and My Sweet Lord. And I would kind of say, oh, we're going to prove that these songs are like each other. But I also did it with REO Speedwagon by basically, I'm going to prove that every REO Speedwagon song's lyrics can be sung to any other REO Speedwagon song. And eventually they just said, all right, do whatever you want. You're the only person getting phone calls, so just do whatever you want. So myself and my friends would hang out in the studio, and we would just make up stuff. We would have running skits. My favorite was Eyewitness Weather. We would send Jimmy White out to call from a payphone to tell us what the weather was like outside. So we would send him outside to get the weather. And he would call from a payphone. This is Eyewitness Weather. What's the weather like out there, Jimmy? Well, it's dark. I can't see the moon, so either it's a new moon or it's cloudy.
Or somebody stole it.
And that's Eyewitness Weather with James White.
That, oh my God. I must have done a similar show at the University of Minnesota because, and you and I have sat down and had stories, but it just sounds like the time Dave, my partner, he looked out the window, and now we would be looking out over the Mississippi Washington Bridge, and off to the left would be Comstock, which at the time was the women's dorm. And he would say something like, well, I just saw two old ladies mug a grad student, so I call the weather muggy. Plus, she's a very attractive co-ed, showering with her curtain open. Thank you very much. And, man, we'd get calls like, oh, my God, that's me. How did you know it was me? No, you don't understand. From the window, we can see the facade, but we can't see into any windows. We're at a perfect right angle to it. So maybe we should do that sometime. We'll just sit back and regale people with our college tales. Radio.
But I had a theme this week.
You did?
And we even
talked about it a little last week. Oh, by the way, you can blame Ron Elred for that because he sent me a bunch. He was alluding to the fact that he has a lot of stories about you. But he was saying that pretty much what you're saying, how you guys used to annoy the crap out of the station manager. That play format go way off track.
I don't know if there is really any dirt on me.
Yeah, it's mostly your own imagination.
Yeah, just cleaning.
You're a very clean person.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if there's any real dirt on me. I don't think so. There's, people that I've had in my life who've decided that they hate me. But then again, what the stuff they come up with is, well, that, I think we were all in the room and know that's not true. But,
I wouldn't call it hate. I would call it more of an bemused detachment.
That's just how you feel about me.
Yeah, that's true. I'm just annoyed because you never share pie.
Damn. God.
But on the other hand, when I have pie and I don't share it, I do empathize with how you feel.
Joe, I failed sharing in kindergarten. And I've never picked up the skill. I really don't see a point in it.
I got to write this down. For the next solo, Joe, interview Corey's mom. I'm sorry, was that out loud? No, thanks.
But I had a theme for this episode that's related to comics.
But I don't. can't we just talk about our vacation plans? That was actually more fun.
Well, for you.
Yeah, of course.
I fell asleep.
Well, good. Now you know how what I do when you go on your monologues. Not the last one. That was actually interesting. But
we've talked about different kinds of comics, and one of the comics that we don't talk a lot about are military/war-themed comics. And I was looking at the stuff in previews, and there aren't a lot of them anymore. But at one point, you know, in World War II, comics sold better than they ever had. And then when the Korean War started, all the publishers were like, oh, good, we're going to sell comics again. But they were always kind of a theme when comics were on the newsstand, to the point where even kids who said they didn't like comics would buy war comics. I can't tell you how many kids who said, oh, I don't like comics, would have copies of Sergeant Rock or Sergeant Fury or stuff like that. So I thought we could go over 5 of our favorite military/war comics.
And I told Corey, we have a problem because I don't think I have 5. But as we talk, I'm hoping Corey will tickle the old memory banks and I might remember, oh yeah, I read that.
Oh yeah.
So I'll play along.
All right, for my number 5.
You know what I'm saying, folks? I mean, otherwise this podcast would have ended at episode 3.
Oh, no, I would have just kept going.
Yeah, that's true. Today I interview this coconut head.
Actually, it'd be, I got this omnibus. I'm going to talk about it.
Today I'm going to eat this cherry pie.
Now when I go to work, I have to stop at the gas station and raid the hostess.
Which isn't real pie, but any pie in its form. Sorry.
It's pie. It's small pie. It's a pie crust with
a chemical
filling.
There is nothing natural about Hostess cream pies.
I don't eat cream pies. I eat the fruit pies.
The good folks at Hostess want to send us a bunch, and we will review them on our show.
So,
be careful. Somebody's listening.
Number 5 was actually one of the first war comics I bought. And, Joe, you know Mark Evanier, correct?
Not personally. He won't return my calls anymore. Not since the incident.
Oh, you didn't chat with him when you were at the San Diego Con?
Nope. But I did sit in his panels. He's an awesome panelist.
And Dan Spiegel is an artist who worked in comics forever and ever and ever. They did a run of Blackhawk in the early 80s. And I knew next to nothing about the Blackhawk characters. But I did like Mark Evanier's stuff, and I didn't know Dan Spiegel, but that comic introduced me to his art. Well, I'd seen Dan Spiegel's art, but he didn't sign his name to stuff because he worked over at Gold Key. But they did a run of Blackhawk for DC in the early 80s. That was just a phenomenal read. It used a lot of the old Blackhawk ideas, like the war wheel and things like that. But it also updated the characters so they weren't such horrible stereotypes. Looking at you, Chop Chop. And
oh, God, that tickled the memory.
And it was just
a pie
phenomenal
face in Green Lantern.
It was
pie face.
Yeah, pie face. Ugh.
Ebony!
I doubt we're going to see. Well, they did bring back Pie Face, but they had him use his real name, and no one calls him Pie Face anymore, thank God. But the Blackhawk run that he and Dan Spiegel did was just a phenomenal read. I'm shocked it's never been reprinted, but you can the back issues are still pretty cheap. And it's probably the best Blackhawk run ever. You know, I love the Blackhawk stuff by Howard Chaykin, but it was taking Blackhawk and kind of reinventing it, whereas Evanier kind of went back to the core but told it in a more modern style. So if you're looking for those, it was a DC run of Blackhawk in the late 80s. I'm sorry, the early 80s. Joe?
The first one I remember ever buying was the 1979 dollar comic All out war. And I only bought it for 6 months because it got canceled at issue six. I don't know why I bought it. I think it was a big thing. DC was pushing to dollar comics. I was buying Superman Family. I bought Time Warp. And I figured, hey, might as well buy it all. Because, you know, back then I naively figured, sooner or later I will have one of every comic ever published.
And Jerome.
Well, yeah, but he had a head start on me. Plus the fact is that I turned around and started selling my comics, which if I had, you know, you see those memes. If you could go back in time and tell yourself something in three words, what would it be? Mine don't sell anything. Not only do I miss some of the stuff I sold, but I could downright retire right now just by some of the god-awful prices on some of these things. But anyways, All Out War was just six-issue war comic. Had kind of unconventional ones. They had the all-black fighting men of the Black Eagle Force in World War II. There was a brave dog that had a talent for sniffing out the enemy during the Vietnam War. And, of course, the headliner, Viking Commando, who takes a detour from his trip to Valhalla in order to thwart the Nazis, whom he recognizes as his eternal enemies, the Huns. And other than buying and reading it, there's not much I remember of this series, except the fact that sooner or later I will run across it in a dollar bin somewhere and probably just snap it up and reread it. I've done it since with the other dollar comics and found a few stories that I actually really enjoyed. So, Corey?
The next one I have is a Jack Kirby book. I know, it's a shock, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Now, I have not read very much of Jack Kirby's war comics from the 50s, although as they drop into public domain, I am reading them. But he did a run of The Losers. And I did not read any of the DC war comics when I was a kid because I didn't read any DC comics. But when I found out that Kirby had done a run of The Losers, I was trying to find it. But because it was a war comic, not many... It was hard to find in back issues. About 5 years ago, DC reprinted his entire run in a hardcover, and I was able to sit and read them. And it was very easy to tell, and they talked about it in the foreword and the afterword, that Kirby hated the idea of the book. He didn't want to do stories about losers. And he did what he always did. He came on the book, reinvented it, and kind of turned it into him telling stories about when he was in World War II. Of course, you know, he made it more comic booky, you know, made it action-adventure-y, but a lot of the basis of it was some of the World War II stories that he had been telling people since the 40s. And this was the work of a mature man who's, you know, 30 years removed from World War II, being told, make this entertaining. It's Kirby at his peak in a lot of ways, because the art was being inked by Mike Royer, who was one of the, came on after Vince Coletta at DC and did just a beautiful job on Kirby's pencils. But the stories are action. They're they go everywhere from humor to pathos, and it's just one of the best Kirby runs of any book in the 70s. But the other thing is I'm finding the stuff he did in the 50s, they're all like one-shots. This was continuing characters, and a lot of ways it was a more mature Sergeant Fury. Because Sergeant Fury, you know, it was a fun book, but let's be honest, Sergeant Fury was goofy as hell. And the book is still available. If you head out there, it's one of the Kirby DC books. I like to think that it's an unknown gem because it didn't sell well at the time. After a little while, they didn't even have Kirby covers on it anymore because DC felt that Joe Kubert covers sold war books. So it wasn't long before Kubert was doing the covers, which is kind of a shame because Kirby's covers on the first few are just phenomenal. But it's a very enjoyable book, and I highly recommend it. Joe?
The only other, or I should say maybe the second war comic I remember buying was started in 86 and ended in 93, called The Nam, from Marvel Entertainment. If I recall right, the original pitch was that they were going to go in real time and talk about Vietnam and what was going on and sort of cover it. And of course, in 86, I got to say, during my grade school and high school years, never knew what the Vietnam War was about. I was born in 65. It was going on then. Had some vague notion of it because when I read old Doonesbury strips where he's talking about BD and he was over in Vietnam and he met Fred the Communist. And so, and I know my uncle was in it. He showed me his Purple Heart. But we never really studied it. I didn't until college actually take classes where they actually talked about Vietnam. So you basically, you had a whole generation ignorant of what was going on with it. I thought this would be an interesting way of kind of getting the gist to it. It was supposedly integrating stories that people had of it. I do remember characters dying. I do remember one being taken as a POW, which I guess we never found out. The concept eventually, I think, died because people just weren't buying it. Eventually, they broke away. They just told stories. They brought in the Punisher to kind of liven things up. But eventually, I think the issue, it just kind of died. People weren't interested. Matter of fact, the last issue, 84, if you can find it, was interesting because it was told from the Vietnamese point of view. The comic was supposed to run as long as the war did. It actually fell short of the goal. But I suppose, you know, if you count, okay, 1966 to 1973, yeah, I guess they covered quite a bit, but they never really rounded it out. So it was an interesting book. I kind of think I might have stopped it around the 30s, maybe. But I just, you know, all the characters just started looking alike. Might have been 46. I know they started different people writing in that, but it was an interesting story. Maybe brought up a little bit more to the conflict in Vietnam that, you know, I was woefully ignorant of until, you know, I studied it on my own. And it's available. I don't know. Is this a Marvel Unlimited?
I would have to look. The NAM was one of mine. Was my next one, actually.
Okay, we'll go into it.
It was actually started by Doug Murray, who was a Vietnam War vet, and drawn by Michael Golden. And when Michael Golden showed up, this was kind of the first series he'd done since the Micronauts. So it was almost 10 years between him doing Marvel series. And they said, this is going to be, you know, in real time, a month in the comic will be a month in here. And Doug Murray treated it very seriously. He started early where the U.S. was just the, what were they called? Consultants.
Advisors.
Yeah. And showed how they slowly got drawn into the war. And I recommend this book up to Doug Murray leaving. And you could tell that by around issue 40, they were kind of telling him to goose the sales. Because on issue 40, they had all of the Marvel superheroes on the cover. And then you read the story, and it was about Marvel Comics at the PX and the soldiers buying them. And the book was popular enough that they actually had a black and white magazine that reprinted it. And they would reprint two issues of the comic in each issue of the Black and White magazine. And it was kind of the last gasp for Marvel for Black and White magazines, because they also did a Destroyer magazine. But really, the only one that survived was Savage Sword of Conan. And it was, up until Doug Murray left, it was well done. It was educational. Because, like Joe, I was born in 1964. Don't do the math.
You're old.
So, and my parents protected me from hearing about the Vietnam War. And a lot of the stuff that people said happened during the Vietnam War, oh, soldiers came back and they were treated poorly. Well, we were in small town, you know, Illinois. When a soldier came back, they had parades. You know, we didn't see anything about that. I never saw a war protest. It was, you know, always, you know, and everybody's car had the bumper sticker, America, love it or leave it. And even now, even though I lived through the Vietnam War, I still feel like I don't know enough about it. But that comic told it from the soldier's point of view. And Marvel, the problem was that Marvel eventually wanted to turn it into a war comic. So they did a story about Punisher and his time in Vietnam. And then it then they handed it over to Chuck Dixon, who just did rah, rah, adventure, America's great, let's go kill the Viet Cong stories, rather than the more complex stories that Doug Murray was doing about the moral quandary, about how it wasn't black and white, and it wasn't good and evil, and neither side was completely good, and neither side was completely evil, and the soldiers had to deal with the fact that not knowing who the enemy was. You know, they could be in town, and North Vietnamese soldiers could be there, and if they're in regular clothes, they don't, you know, there's no way to know. He dealt beautifully with that ambiguity and how the soldiers dealt with the constant stress. And he also was very cognizant of having characters come in and out of the book. You know, they would come in for their tour of duty. And after their tour of duty, they would circle back home. So he was always bringing in new characters and having other characters leave. And I think that might have been a problem as well, because us comic book fans, we want the main character to be there in every issue. You know, look at how people lost their minds when somebody else is Captain America or Iron Man or Thor. You know, people lose their minds because they want that continuity of character. And the NAM wasn't built for that until Doug Murray left, and then that's what it became. But those Doug Murray issues, especially the early ones with Michael Goldenhart, those are just phenomenal, phenomenally well done. There was another comic around the same time by another Vietnam vet named Don Lomax, and it was put out through Apple, and it was called Vietnam Journal. And it was more based on his point of view. And the stories were good, but Lomax's art, I always had a little problem with it. And I can't really finger on why. His art just isn't pleasant. And even the other stuff he did, some stuff at First Comics. His stuff is hard for me to read. There's just something about it that strikes me the wrong way. But the stories were good, so it's one of those where I would force myself through the stories despite the art. But on the NAM, you had that Michael Golden art, and oh my god, Michael Golden, why aren't you drawing more comics, damn it? Joe?
Oddly enough, the next one I have down is Punisher the Platoon, which is a fairly new one. Just last year, limited series through Marvel under their Max imprint, written by Garth Ennis, which got my attention because I love Garth Ennis' Punisher.
He does this great war comics, too.
He does. And this one centers around the character of Frank Castle during his first tour of Vietnam as a young man. And the plot was just, it had him as a framing narrative, both the American soldiers, Castle's platoon, and an NVA general being interviewed in the modern day. And it was just wonderful. I mean, pause the podcast, run out to your local comic store. You should be able to find it. I don't think there's a book out yet of it, but you know it's coming. And hopefully, if Marvel's got their act together, there will be another comic of a similar theme, because it struck me as very genuine. They used a lot of the military terms. It'd be interesting to hear from somebody who is from the military that read this, if they found this credible, or if there were some things like, yeah, well, you know, this wouldn't have happened, because I always find that I always find that stuff interesting myself. Trying to think, I'm looking for the art. How could they not list the art on this? But it was good. Definitely worth picking up. Mr. Strode.
The number two, as we count backward, I feel like Casey Kasem. Back to the countdown. Coming in at number two was a short-lived magazine from Warren. It only lasted four issues. It had art from Wally Wood, Frank Frazetta, Alex Toth, and every story in it was written by Archie Goodwin, and that's the magazine called Blazing Combat. When Warren did their books, they had the horror comics, just like EC, and Archie Goodwin pitched them to do a war comic, and this was in 1965, so the Vietnam War was just kind of at the edge of everybody's consciousness. So they started the magazine, and it was short stories in the EC vein of not... They dealt with the ambiguity of war. They dealt with the victims of war. They dealt with it wasn't a gung-ho, rah-rah book. It was very much, these are short stories about what goes on in war. And it only lasted four issues because one of Jim Warren's biggest selling points was that he got his magazines, like Famous Monsters of Filmland, Creepy, Eerie, later Vampirella, into Army PXs. And when Blazing Combat came out, the military read it and said, we will not allow this in any of our PXs. And they kind of went to distributors and said, we don't want this anti-war commie comic book on newsstands because it will hurt the war effort. So I guess he lost money on every issue. It usually took a magazine about 3 to 4 issues before it would start making money. But Blazing Combat, because he lost the PXs, was losing money with every issue. And he canceled it despite the fact that he was very proud of the book, that he was putting a lot of resources into it. And you can actually buy a hardcover that has all of the stories from Fantagraphics. And it's beautiful artwork. Just some beautiful artwork. Come on! You've got Frank Frazetta. You've got Alex Toth. You've got Wally Wood. You've got all these great artists. And Archie Goodwin was in full EC writer mode. Phenomenal, phenomenal book. You can pick it up for $30. That's the cover price, but you could probably get it cheaper on Amazon. It's got a really good interview with Archie Goodwin in it. It's got an interview with Jim Warren in it, and it goes into the distribution problems they had. But highly recommended. Still to this day, the stories seem fresh and new, and because Goodwin dealt with the ambiguity of war, and again, another one of those books where it wasn't all black and white, just... I cannot recommend it enough, Joe. Your last one?
Last one. I thought we were on two.
Yeah, that was my number two. After two comes one.
Yeah, but you started.
Oh, so
I'm
okay.
Only on number two.
Oh, you're only on number two. So.
Because as you talk, I'm remembering other comics that I read that wore. So I'm like, hey, I don't want to be cut off here. Originally, I came in with two, just Nam and... All-Star War. But I remember one...
By the way, Joe, Infinity War does not count.
Okay, fine. I'll do this one instead. Corey, do you remember the United States invasion of Grenada?
Yes, I do. Grenada?
So, again, this is a history thing for you guys. In 83, I was as graduating high school, and apparently the bad guys of this particular time period, the communists, took over... a small island in called Grenada, which I guess is about 100 miles north of Venezuela. And through somewhat of secrecy, I guess Reagan had the armed forces go in, and within a matter of weeks, we pretty much took care of everything. I'm not going to get into the history about it because, you know, whether you believe they were just looking for a fight, because one of the things that happened out of Vietnam War is that there was a kind of a pullback. Suddenly being in armed services wasn't necessarily a good idea, wasn't a career move. Budgets were cut. And then, of course, there was this little-known country you probably haven't heard about called Afghanistan that the Soviets at the time invaded. And that was kind of a wake-up call to, like, hey, you know, just because we don't want to have soldiers doesn't mean there's a reason we shouldn't have it. So starting under Carter and definitely going into the Reagan years, the military started building up again. And in order to make America feel great, we went into Grenada. We went in kind of quiet. They didn't really give a lot of a headway. They kept the tamper on the media. Those that were embedded had to be quiet about it until mission was accomplished. And it's kind of like we woke up one day and there was ham radio operator saying that the United States was invading his country. And then later on, you know, we're like, yeah, whatever, whatever. And then about 2 days later, at least in my recollection, the news was like, yes, we did invade and we were able to secure the country and drive the communists out. I think we were originally going in because there was some Americans there that were in peril, but how this deals with comics? Well, apparently in 1983, there was a Grenada comic book that allegedly was produced by the CIA that was to be airdropped over Grenada during the invasion. I found it because in the Comic Buyer's Guide, the weekly newspaper at the time, they were selling these. You could pick up, like, they were, I think they're selling for like 10 a piece, or you could pick up like 5 or 10 for less. And I picked up 10 of them because I figured, what the heck of it. And, you know, we sold them at the shows that Pat and I did. And then, of course, I probably forgot about them. Years later, as I you know, digging through my vast accumulation of crap, I discovered these, and I had like two left. I look online, they're going for upwards of like $200. Because when they came out, nobody paid attention to them. Had to do some research on them, and there's people saying there is no way this comic was published and dropped over Grenada during the invasion, because the time they published and printed these, the invasion was over. So that's probably why they were blowing them out. Somebody got a warehouse find of these things and was just selling them off. You know, a bunch of things that I got for nothing. If I got $5 a piece on them. I bet you had a wish you had a case of them now. From what I remember reading it, it was pretty much the narrative that I just told you. Americans in trouble, communist bad guys, we come in as liberators. I don't want to get too much into it because, you know, there's probably some more history behind this that maybe proves that what I'm saying isn't true. This is definitely a propaganda piece, but it was something that was interesting nonetheless, and it tied into comics. So if you can find one, say you're digging through a quarter box, just a little blue cover with, you know, the top's got the bad communists killing the people March 13th, 1979, and then in October 83, we're releasing the prisoners, and then, of course, at the bottom, there's rescued from rape and slavery, thanks to the United States. So, you know, it's a $200, well, probably by now $100 to $200 comic. So if you can get it for less, yeah, that's one to pick up and flip. It's printed on newsprint, so it's not the best quality. It just says number one of a series. And as far as I know, they never did another one. I think the CIA probably figured, you know, by the time we print these suckers, most of the conflicts will be over. So, but it was a success. The specter of Vietnam was behind us. At least that's what they were telling us at the time. So,
and it was just a few days after there was the bombing of the military barracks in Lebanon. So those two things weren't connected at all, were they?
Oh, never, never, never. And there were Cuban forces on the island. So, I mean, that was probably the way, you know, at the time the Cubans were bad. So anyways, that's my number two. Corey? What's your number one?
My number one is one that I don't think will ever be topped. And that is Two-Fisted Tales / Frontline Combat, edited by Harvey Kurtzman. This was EC at its finest. Harvey Kurtzman started Two-Fisted Tales wanting to do an adventure comic because he didn't much care for horror. And he didn't really fit into the science fiction, so when they offered him a editorship, he pitched Two-Fisted Tales. And the thing was that William Gaines and Al Feldstein, who at the time were putting together most of the stories for the other books, didn't grasp how to do those stories either, because if you read the first issue of Two-Fisted Tales, you could tell their story because it's god-awful. But within a few issues, the Vietnam War started, and they started Frontline Combat thinking, oh, you know, war comics are going to be big because the Korean War. And Two-Fisted Tales switched over to war, and it showed Kurtzman as probably one of the best editors of comics of all time. What Kurtzman would do, he would, rather than give a script or anything, he would actually draw out, thumbnail out, how he wanted the pages to look, and then give it to the artists. And the artists he had were a murderer's row. Wally Wood, Al Williamson, Jack Davis, Bill Elder, Alex Toth, on down the line, George Evans, just on down the line. Every issue, the artists in there are some of the greatest artists ever to work in comics. And Kurtzman demanded authenticity. To the point where when he would do a story about World War I, he would send Jack Davis down to the museum to look at World War I planes to make sure that he had the proper number of rivets drawn. For the Civil War, special issues where Kurtzman wanted to tell the entire story of the Civil War in the comic, and he would do every so often a Civil War special issue, and the four stories would be about the Civil War. He would have them research the uniforms to make sure the uniforms were exact. If they could, they would go to where the battles were so they could see the lay of the land. But also, this is in 1952, 53, and 54, and if you read other comics, any other war comic at the time, the American soldier is a superhero who can defeat everybody, and he's always right about everything he does. Not in Kurtzman's books. Kurtzman's books were about what goes on in war. They were about the mistakes, the blunders, the errors, the fog of war, the small heroics, the big heroics. One of the best comic stories ever is Corpse on the Imogen, which is about a corpse going down the river in Korea and talking about what's going on, that the corpse is going by, how this soldier died and why his body is being washed down the river. And I defy anybody to read that story and not be moved by just how powerful it is. I learned more about the Civil War in those comics than I did any of my classes in junior high and high school, because Kurtzman cared about detail, and it wasn't about glorifying one side or the other. It was about, this is what happened. They are all available from Dark Horse in archives. If you are looking to get EC, I would start with those. I would buy those first. Then get the horror comics, then the science fiction comics, and then the crime comics. Because those war comics have never been equaled in any form. Just recently we're starting to get war movies that reach the complexity of Kurtzman's war comics. And anybody else who has done war comics since then is just, you know, trying desperately to keep up with what he did 60 years ago. And again, that murderer's row of artists, every single page in those books will blow you out of the water. Joe, I don't know if you've read a lot of EC books or not, but the art...
No, not really.
The art is... I can't tell you how many artists were inspired to start drawing because of the art in those books. The whole underground movement started as Harvey Kurtzman fan fiction. If you read a lot of the Underground War comics, they're trying desperately to do what Kurtzman was doing in Two-Fisted Tales and Frontline Combat. Now, when Frontline Combat was canceled, and then Kurtzman was busy working on Mad as a Monthly, John Severin took over as the editor. And the stories took a step down, but the art never wavered, because you had John Severin at his peak. And he very much wanted to keep up that tradition of that complete tradition of authenticity and detail. He wasn't as good a writer, so they took a stumble. But the weird thing is, him taking a step down was still 20 steps higher than anybody else had ever done War comics in the past. And I would dare say that they were more sophisticated than the War movies that came out at the time, including From Here to Eternity. So, for me, that is the best military theme / war comic of all time. Joe?
Well, I had a dilemma because I have two that I couldn't decide who would be number one. They're both graphic novels, but the first one was Last Days of Vietnam by Will Eisner, which is a graphic novel done in 2000. It's an anthology that was a mix of tales, observation, retelling of slice of life stories. Eisner, who served in the Army during World War II, did a magazine on vehicle maintenance until 71, and he used stories that he got in contact with soldiers and from his own experience to do six tales of the last day of Vietnam. And there are other stories that take place during World War II, Korea, and Vietnam as well. But for me, the one that I thought was above all others wasn't necessarily a war comic, but it was more a view from its victims. That's, of course, Art Spiegelman's Mouse. If you've never read it, it's basically Spiegelman frames a story by him interviewing his father during his days in Poland, during World War II, before he emigrated to the United States. And this is during when the Holocaust was spreading across Europe. His dad and his wife were taken prisoners, placed in separate camps, struggling to survive and unite. It's a story that, when it was originally serialized in Raw, just knocked the world on its ass. I think this was between Watchmen, Dark Knight, and Mouse. They all came around the same time, and they basically grabbed the world and basically showed them, hey, this format that we've been regulating to just kids' fare. Even though, if you listen to what Corey said about his pick, these were not kids' magazines, but comics in the United States were always kiddie fare. They were always for the kids. They weren't supposed to be controversial. You're supposed to follow the code. Well, these were done as graphic novels, and they didn't have to. And if you've never read them, they're quite unsettling. They're disturbing. It's a very dark history of mankind, and of course there's a number of knuckleheads that will insist, despite the evidence and the pictures and the survivors, the ones that exist, that, oh no, it never happened, never happened, fake history. Well, I got two words for you, but instead of saying it, I'm just going to recommend that you check out Mouse. I did have the privilege of actually interviewing Art Spiegelman back during my radio days. Greg Ketter had him in the shop, and this was his Dinkytown shop when he was on the corner that the theater is currently on. If you ever drive down 4th Street, you'll recognize the building. And I was able to go in. I set up. I recorded him. We did commercials, and then we come back, and it was done live. I was dismayed to find out that although the guy who was feeding the feed into the radio was paying attention, he did not start the tape. So there's no recording of it. Art was brilliant. I mean, and this was when it was starting to come out. I mean, now he's pretty much. I haven't met him since then, but I mean, I can't imagine he's like Neil Gaiman, you know, nice guy, but he's not just going to show up and do a signing. He's going to do an event. Back then, though, he could just do a signing. He signed my, at the time, volume one of Mouse. He put a little sketch into my my sketchbook that one of these days I'll get up for everyone to enjoy. It was rainy, snowy that day, so I just, after talking to the guys at the station, they just said, go ahead, take the remote unit. And the remote unit was a thing about the size of four laptops stacked, and you plugged it into the phone line, and then you had his microphone, my microphone, and then back in the station, they edited the levels to make sure that it worked. So just a fun piece of personal history. Again, kudos to Greg Ketter for having him. Thanks, Art Spiegelman, for the interview. And if you've never read it, you can go out and buy The Complete Mouse. And again, this is more from the victims of war. You know, we've seen some from the soldiers, and, you know, we talk about the military planners, but you forget there's people on the ground dying and being affected by these wars. So never forget that. Next time you hear somebody talking about, yeah, well, you know, we could just nuke North Korea and Iran and everything would be fine. And that was my number one.
You know who doesn't have any comic recommendations, but instead has razors and snacks, Joe?
I like snacks.
Well, then you should listen to these guys, our sponsors. That's right, here at the Solitaire Rose Radio Network, we have ads, and our first sponsor is me. That's right, your charming and delightful old Uncle Rat Bastard. I have my first book out with Dangerous Dan Moore. It's the first 100 strips of our online web strip, Worldwide News, the story of the lowest-rated cable news network. And you can get yourself a copy with commentary, with all sorts of extras, with signatures and everything. Just email Dan over at lordshadowflame@gmail.com. Our top sponsor, who's been with us since day one, is DreamHost. DreamHost.com. You need yourself a website, and DreamHost.com is the number one web host in the whole known universe. Just head over to DreamHost.com, put in the code CRAZY, K-R-A-Y-Z, get $20 off your first year. How can you beat that? Our other sponsor is Graze, G-R-A-Z-E.com. Healthy snacks for a healthy lifestyle. Just head over to Graze, put in the code CORYS3R5P. Your first and fifth box are free. You can get them weekly. You can get them bi-weekly. You can get them monthly. You just order a whole bunch of them. It's great stuff to keep you away from the vending machine at work. Now, if you would like to leave a comment for any of the podcasts that we do, we'd love those. Go ahead and email us at solitairerosenetwork@gmail.com, or you can call 952-856-0519. Operators are standing by. Okay, it's just a place that we'll record your calls, but we'll play them on the air. We'll answer your questions. We love getting feedback. Tell us what you think. Ask a question. Suggest a topic. Be a guest. Send us your stuff. SolitaireRoseNetwork@gmail.com. If you would like to advertise on any of the Solitaire Rose radio shows, you can. Just email us at SolitaireRoseNetwork@gmail.com. Subject, advertising. Thanks. I actually had one of their new snacks today. It was an oat square with one of those new superfoods and maple drizzle. Oh. You put maple drizzle on just about anything and I'll eat it. You get a good maple drizzle, I'll eat a paper plate.
And the sad thing is Corey gets all the snacks. I get butt kiss.
Well, that's because I'm paying for my snacks. You could subscribe. You get your first and fifth box free.
Hey, listen, if it was the pie of the month club, I could understand you not sharing, but come on, it's drizzle. Show me some drizzle love. Ooh, that didn't come out right, did it?
Yeah, I don't.
Just forget it, forget it.
Although I may save that and use it against you at a later point.
Oh, yeah, as if I'll remember saying it. Yeah, fake podcast.
What do you think of that, Angel?
Screw you, Strode.
Angel says that every time.
Yeah, he's even on video saying that.
Well, you do know we have other podcasts, right, Joe?
We should, because God knows I'm not doing any solo Joes frequently.
You did one last week.
Yeah, that was kind of just see. That was like a pilot episode or a repilot. If Star Trek has two, I can have two.
Well, Star Trek's had how many pilots now? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
Only two real pilots. Because you remember the first one with Pike was more of a surprise, and it wasn't because it was too intellectual. What it was is NBC and the powers that be did not think that Desilu Studio, who is right now only known for I Love Lucy, could actually pull off a show as intricate as Star Trek. And they kind of were like, well, this isn't really what we want. But
they also weren't real happy with Gene Roddenberry's extramarital affair girlfriend being shoved down as the number two character in the show.
Although she did show up later. But in the second pilot, when they ordered it, that was unheard of. And I can't think of any other show in the history of television that they actually said, well, tell you what, do another pilot and let's see how that goes.
I can.
Oh, which one?
Seinfeld.
Oh, so there you have it. There's two. And if there's any more, let us know.
But there are a whole bunch of Star Trek pilots, though. There are the two for the original series. There's Encounter at Farpoint for Next Generation.
No, that's not a pilot. That's that was the regular episode.
No, that was a pilot. That was what they filmed.
No, because they had the series ready to go. So that wasn't really a pilot. Although you could say the one where Project Earth, where Gary Seven showed up.
Yeah.
That was a backdoor pilot.
Yep, that was a backdoor pilot. I would say that there was a pilot for all of them, basically saying, okay, let's give this a try. But you could also say that the first two episodes of Star Trek Discovery were a pilot.
I would have to look on that, because a lot of times those series were already committed to before they came forward. They didn't make Deep Space Nine with the idea, okay, do a pilot, and if we like it, we're doing it. They were already committed to doing it. So technically, not a pilot, more of a first episode. Whereas a pilot is, like you said, here's what we got, we're showing it around, because they do tons of pilots. And the fact that they made the pilot is a step above the fact, well, we're just shopping it. That means somebody's interested. Now, when the bigwigs see the pilot, that's where they will commit to whether they'll do it or not. A couple of classic ones, if you ever notice, there was a Hogan's Heroes black and white episode. I don't know if you've ever seen it, where they had a Russian in there, and there was an adjutant Clank. And when they went down into the dungeon where they had a sauna, they were printing money, they were making Lugers to sell at markets. Clink secretary was down there as a masseuse. And they had a Russian guy. And when they did the pilot, they said, okay, we like that, but get rid of the Russian guy. Don't make it so ham-fisted, you know, don't make it so incredulous, as if the whole show wasn't incredulous. And then they had the first episode. And then they went back and they revisited that same episode, used the script, and brought the same characters back, sans the Russian. The Monkees had a similar one where there was one episode where it was a pilot, and it's in very different format than the rest of the episodes. And if I'm not mistaken, they actually, Monkees is one of the few episode TV shows where the Beatles actually agreed to let them use their music in it. Most, I think it was their very last episode. Most of the time the Beatles did not let them do that. But a pilot is something very different. I mean, if you get the classic Casablanca movie, big anniversary, they have the pilot episode for the ill-fated David Soul Casablanca show.
TV series.
Ugh. So, yeah, and sometimes, wasn't there a Wildcats pilot? Jim Lee's Wildcats?
Yep. One of the things they do now, they don't do full pilots. They only do like about a 10 to 15 minute pilot that's part of an episode to show what the show will be like, because they don't want to spend the money if the show's not going to get picked up. But that has nothing to do with the fact that we've got other shows, Joe.
And we might have some pilots, too.
Really?
Well, if anybody wants to attach their podcast to the Solitaire Rose Network, you know what to do. Send Corey a pie and a copy of it.
And I pretty much will let anybody on. I mean, I let Jody.
I'm trying to get you some pie, you dumbass.
Well, we'll be talking about pie later on.
Okay. What?
And now we get to Joe's favorite part of the show. No, not where he breaks a Fabergé egg and has to replace it with a painted version he printed off the internet. What's going on the eBays?
I'm a whiz with paper mache. Okay, time to peel back kayfabe. Folks, this is being recorded basically 2 to 3 days after the last one. So not a lot has changed on the eBays from the last time. I'm still trying to catch up from the 2 weeks I took off, 1 week being for the con. And then the second week when I was on vacation, I actually had my store on vacation. And we'll get to I think I was freaking about it last time when all my listings disappeared. Did I go on to that freaking last time? Okay, so I won't. But I did find a workaround, so everything's up, and now you shall enjoy the fun of a fully loaded and operational eBay. Crazy, K-R-A-Y-Z. And who knows, between now and next week, I might even have sold some stuff. That's what sucks when you go on vacation. It's like the momentum you had selling stuff stops, and then it just takes a while to get moving again. Because, you know, I've got things I'm going to be adding, things I'm dropping. You know, I got oodles of stuff to try. So, and you can be the first. If you see something you like, let me know. I'll give you a bonus out of my accumulation of crap, such as, I got to tell you, Dan, Dangerous Dan Moore was mighty disappointed with me at the Comic-Con.
No, why?
Not because I was openly oogling his wife. I mean, she had a fantastic Doctor Strange costume. Have you seen photos of it?
Yes, I have.
Oh, amazing. But the guy next to him was one of my customers and I believe a listener of the podcast, Scott Gallatin, another creator. I gave him a copy of your Worldwide News, one of the unautographed ones I had. And Dan was upset because now he had nothing to trade with Scott with. So there.
And now we get to my favorite part of the show. Not where I talk about how it's sundress season for an hour and a half.
Ooh.
By the way, Joe, it's sundress season.
I know. I hope you shaved your back. I got to get my bikini zone done.
No, it's freaking and geeking. Joe, what are you freaking on?
I have had the worst rheumatoid arthritis attack these last couple days that I've had in a long, long time. It's probably caused by not only the funky weather we're having. I don't know if you can hear the thunder bopping around outside. But... you know, we did a lot of walking on our vacation, and due to Memorial Day, my meds, instead of showing up today, will be showing up tomorrow. And that means I've been going about a week without the meds, which is enough for the rheumatoid to start flaring up. Plus the fact, you know, I imagine all the walking. Last night, I just could not get to sleep. I was so achy. And I just finally, I got down on the ground. I almost threw in the DDP yoga, but I knew Chris and Holly were sleeping. I didn't want to wake them up. So I just started doing all the stretches I remember being given ever since I've had rheumatoid. And eventually I found, you know, you get down and you get to the core muscle or joint that's what's really achy. And then I would slap an ice pack on it for 10 minutes. And after about an hour of doing this, I took a big gulp of water, and I was able to actually get to sleep for a while. So today I'm just achy, but I'm not. I mean, good Lord, I could. It was just one of those days I just didn't want to move. I don't know what's worse, Corey, having an RA attack that is so painful that you just mentally shut down, or having anxiety like you talked about, where it just shuts you down. I don't like pain. I don't mind pain if I know it's something I can avoid, but boy, to just sit and just have this ache on you, it's just debilitating. And I'm not saying it's worse or better than the type of shit you have to go through, Corey, but God, why us? We're such nice guys. I share pie.
I'm not nice. I'm kind.
You're a goody two shoes, and that's all we're not even going there. This is my freaking, and I'll freak if I want to. I will freak if I want to. But other than that, like I said, it's only been a couple days, not a lot of things. I did do one day at work, mostly because it was the day before Memorial Day. And as I've said before, if you're working, if you work a holiday, you get paid for it. If you're a normal person, you get the day off with pay. TSA people are not normal. So I get paid my holiday the last time I worked. Had I taken the Sunday off, I would have gotten day off in lieu of holiday, which means I would have kept my 8 hours. But I decided, you know what, I'll go in one day and work. I'll keep the holiday pay because I get regular pay, my Sunday differential, my nighttime differential, and holiday pay. So that one day is going to be pretty solid. Oddly enough, nobody seemed to notice I was gone for a week, which I thought was kind of unusual. But then again, I also know we have 4 separate baggage areas, and it's not unheard of for me to go months at a time and not work with one of my coworkers. There's one of my guys, that fellow lead, Doug. Last time I haven't seen him in over a month. The last time I talked to him, he's like, "Who is this?" I said, "Dude, just because I don't see you months at a time doesn't mean you forget me." "Oh, Ryder, sorry." So that's pretty much it. Corey, what are you freaking on? What pissed you off these last 2 days that you just couldn't hold on and you got to tell everybody about it?
Well, you know how I was having trouble dealing with the awake overnights, right?
Yeah, you pretty much said, "I don't care how much pie you give me, no."
Well, it took me 2 days to recover from the awake overnight that I did on Friday. I came home, slept for a while, woke up, did the podcast, and then kind of dozed in and out until I had to go into work at 6, because we were doing fire drills.
Was that the fun one where you get to pull everything and then go screaming down the hall? Yay! Fire drill, fire drill, fire drill.
No, this is the one where I have to deal with people who are all in wheelchairs and we have to get them out of the building all at the same time.
Catapult.
And then one of the clients likes to what they call elope. And no, that doesn't mean he runs off and get married. That means that when he's outside, he just, yay, and runs.
Sounds like Gregory from
Toward the Freeway.
Okay, now we're...
So I come in and we do that. And then thank goodness it was a sleep shift afterward. And I just zonked. And then woke up and dealt with things. And then at around 9 o'clock, well, around 8 o'clock, we realized that the staff who's supposed to be in at 8 o'clock hasn't shown. That's okay. We've got enough staff till 8:30. She's probably running late. 8:20, she's still not there. We start calling. 8:30, she has not answered, you know, any calls, and the on-call staff is calling around to get somebody to work. Now, I'm only supposed to work till 10. They call, yeah, we haven't. Now, they call at 9:30. Yeah, we haven't been able to get a hold of her. We can't find anybody to work. Corey, is there any way you can stay? And I said, not legally. Now, Joe, why would I say not legally?
Because you're only supposed to work so many hours.
You're only allowed to work 16 hours in a row. And they got in a lot of trouble last year for having people work 17, 18, and 19 hours. So they were like, is there any way you could stay? Not legally.
Nope.
And she went, oh, okay. So 10 o'clock, I left, and they didn't have enough. They only had 2 staff, so they were telling clients, okay, we're not going to church today. Nobody can go outside for a walk. And, you know, within an hour, it was like 90 degrees, so they would have went outside for a walk and come back in like a minute and a half. But then when I got home, I got, oh, I'll take a nap. And I slept for 2 hours. I got up and was up for an hour and a half or so, and then, oh, I'm just so tired, I can't even stay awake. And then Sunday night, Dan and I were going to record 2 episodes of Bad Advice.
And which itself is bad advice.
And we record the first one, and it's a great episode. We're really on point. We're having a lot of fun. And I say, okay, I'll end this recording so we can start the next one. And I start pushing the little button to hang up on the call on Skype. And it won't hang up, and it won't hang up, and it won't hang up, and it won't hang up. And finally, I have to just shut it down, and the recording vanished. So I call Dan back and I go, we lost the recording. He says, oh, do you want to record another episode after this? It's like, Dan, I've been talking for an hour. I'm barely awake and you want me to be funny. We'll be able to get one more episode. Now we record the next episode and Dan's internet starts doing the for the last 2 minutes. So the bad advice that came out on Friday, yeah, I had to end it by saying, yeah, Dan's internet took shit the bed. Comic-wise, I don't have really anything to complain about because the new previews isn't out yet. I'm sure I'll see something there.
Actually, I think it is out. I thought I saw it at the...
It comes out Wednesday. It comes out tomorrow.
Okay, so that was going to be one of my beefs, but I crossed it off because I was actually expecting Box Day this week. Silly Joey.
Nope, Box Day will probably be next week.
Oh.
Your box will be done tomorrow, but you won't get it for a week and a half.
On the plus side, though, if it had come this week, it would show up on Thursday. And nothing drives me crazier than knowing my Box Day will show up on a day I'm not home to get it. Not that I'm worried about people taking it off my doorstep, and I am, but like we've been having just crazy rain. You know, I had one day where the box outside was, you know, just soaked, but fortunately these guys from Discount Comic Book Service packed it in such a way that it didn't really damage anything. Nothing got damaged inside. Everything was pretty watertight. Nevertheless, it's just things I worried about. Me and my comics.
Let's talk about the happy stuff, Joe. What are you geeking on?
I did finish, in a remarkably short amount of time, To the Stars, the autobiography of George Takei. And if you don't know who he is, well, he was Star Trek's Mr. Sulu. And this goes up through 1994. Fascinating book. Unlike most books I read, George Takei had what I would call a fairly decent childhood. I mean, he wasn't part of the internment, the Japanese internment that occurred during World War II. Kind of scary because some of the themes that he touched upon back then seem to be rustling through America nowadays, you know, about them immigrants and how we should do, you know, incarcerate them and push them out. Well, they were saying the same thing about the Japanese then. And one of the differences, though, the Japanese they did it to were actual citizens. Funny how they didn't do it to, you know, Italians and Germans. They just did it to the Japanese. As far as I can tell, and George repeats this, there were no acts of sabotage by any Japanese Americans, whereas with Italian Americans and German Americans, he doesn't say there was, but maybe I think there are records that there were some people that were favorable. So for him, though, he was a kid. He was, I think, 10 or 12. It was a big adventure to him. George had wonderful parents, a very supportive dad and mom. I mean, you read about his father and you almost wish you knew the man. And, of course, talks about his decision to become an actor, how his parents supported him, all the stuff he did in the films he did and the people he worked with. I mean, it's a who's who of Hollywood. I just, off the top of my head, I remember him talking with Cary Grant. And, you know, he did Playhouse 90s, which were very prestigious. He did that while he was still in school. And, of course, it gets up to the Star Trek stuff. And then when it's over, it continues. You know, he gets involved in politics. The things he did in between, you know, trying to get his career going. Star Trek, the movies. It goes all the way through the final one. His attitude of Next Generation, his chance meeting on a plane with Patrick Stewart. And, of course, this is the beginning. I think this is before he was out as a gay man.
Yes.
Or as we call it, a Takei man.
He plays for the other team.
Yes. Well, and I'm sure there were a lot of women that were disappointed because he talks, of course, about you could see the beginning of his beef with Shatner because there was always a lot of things going on. Like Leonard Nimoy got his star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. Everybody was there. but where was Bill? And then when they renamed the flying model of the shuttle, space shuttle, again, they had no idea if this son of a bitch would fly or drop like a rock. Well, fans got it to be named Enterprise. And, to, you know, for you people that don't know your history, yes, it does glide. So, and that was an important part of it because they wanted it to go up and glide back to Earth. Well, if it couldn't glide in the atmosphere, what was the point? It's kind of funny to think that they didn't really know if this thing would work or not. I remember that because I did a science fiction, a science project on it back in the eighth grade on it. And that was one of the big, big concerns they had, which is why they made the Enterprise and then they actually made one that would go into space. And of course, all the Star Trek people were there. But where was Bill? And he repeats that theme over and over. I don't know if Takei knew it at the time, but my guess is from reading Shatner's biography, he was working. So that pretty much ends the mystery of that. But I haven't checked to see if Takei's written another book that goes beyond 94, and I can't help but think it's fascinating because, like, all these actors that I've looked up to and admire, just a fun read, very easily read. I mean, like I said, I was reading it on vacation. I mentioned it the last podcast, and here we are 2-3 days later, and it's done. So, and plus, I found it for free, so that was kind of neat. I love free libraries. The only other thing I've done other than sit around and ache, I watched a half-hour local documentary on James J. Hill. Corey, can you tell the good people who James J. Hill was?
I know he has a house.
Yeah, but do you know why he has a house?
Not really, no.
Well, James J. Hill is one of the... I'm trying to think of how you say it. He was a Canadian-American railroad exec that created the Great Northern Railway, which served the Upper Midwest and Great Plains. Because of his tenacity, thank you. Sorry, Tenacious D. That he was able to keep his railroad running when all the other ones were going bankrupt. He's called the Empire Builder. He was part of the Gilded Era, which means, you know, he was able to, you know, he became rich and you know, he did a lot of philanthropy and things like that. But he also... He also was in charge of the Iron Mesabi Range Iron Mining District up in Minnesota and the rails up there. And, of course, he also he was kind of on the wrong side of during the trust-busting era because he actually went to the Supreme Court. One of the ways he was able to keep his rail running when the other ones during the late 1800s were going out of business was by cutting wages, cutting staff, making people working harder. Well, as you can might have guessed, just like today, if you're suddenly being told, well, you're going to work longer for less pay, you won't necessarily like that. And he forgot the one thing that a lot of these upper crust people forget. Yeah, you may have had the idea, you probably got the financing, and you in fact were the leader and head of this. But if you don't pay your people, you're not going to get anything. And when he suddenly discovered his railway stopped because the guys on the line didn't necessarily take kindly to being paid less, and he said, well, I can do it because it's my railroad. Well, kind of, I'm not gonna get a legal battle, but it went to the Supreme Court and they basically said no, you can't. But he nevertheless, he did survive the trust busting era. His home, like Corey alluded to, is on Summit Avenue in St. Paul, and it's open for tours. The Great Northern eventually became Burlington Northern, which is now, I guess, owned by what's that other guy's name? Buffett?
Oh, Warren Buffett.
Oh, I was thinking the guy who drinks margaritas. But anyways, he's kind of a big local history guy who's a lot of his influences are still felt even though people just totally blank on it now because really nobody studies this stuff anymore. There were no classes on Minnesota history, just like I'm sure, you know, when you go home, Corey, you see all these streets with weird names and you have no idea who the hell they're named after, even though it might have been someone who, well, like Wheelock Avenue, what I live on. Wheelock was the guy who founded the Minnesota Pioneer Press Today it's called the Minnesota Pioneer Press, and it was one of the great newspapers of Minnesota. And what did he get out of it? Well, they named a street after him.
Yeah, I didn't know that. That's great.
I've been traveling up and down this street for years. I feel almost guilty for taking a dump on it when I was back in. Oh, just too much fast food, and I couldn't make it home, and I just, nobody's looking, so.
Yeah, we didn't need to know that.
No, you didn't. Okay, well, maybe we'll just forget that. But so anyways, that was kind of a fun little thing. I do like history, and just to find out more about him. Of course, if you care more, you can look him up on Wikipedia or go buy one of the trillions of books about him because, you know, his the legacy he left behind. It also, I don't care if you've ever been downtown St. Paul. There's the public library building.
Yeah.
He built it. Oh. He built it, including the half that's the James J. Hill Reference Library, which he modeled after. I can't remember who he modeled. Oh, I failed. I got to go back. I erased it. So here, you know, all these years I was telling stories about, you know, how I would pick up my check. I'd go to St. Paul Comic. I'd go to the library, pick up some books, hit McDonald's, at Chinders, go home. I hit the library that James J. Hill helped build. Who knew? Who knows what Corey's geeking on? Corey, tell us, what are you geeking on?
I found out Sunday, because I got to stay up late. It was one of the few nights that I didn't have to work at the group home that night. I didn't have to wake up early in the morning, so I stayed up late. I found out that they update the Marvel Unlimited. You know how they have new comics every Monday? They add them a little after midnight. So I kind of, oh, cool. And it felt like new comic book day. In between my naps and feeling all discombobulated, I watched the first 2.5 episodes of the new season of The Toys That Made Us. So there was one on the Star Trek toys, which was very interesting. And I remember some of the really crappy toys that they point out. Matter of fact, I might have had a few of the really crappy toys that they point out. I'm looking at you, Spock helmet.
I was thinking that the phaser spinner, you know, where you just put the plastic thing on and you go click, 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 click,
yes,
and you hit it. And it goes,
one of those caused me to break my jaw when I was in sixth grade. My uncle had one, and he was shooting it at me. And I took off running and tried to run down the stairs and did not do a good job of it. Fell down the stairs face first. And there was a door at the bottom of those stairs. So I bam, right into the door. My mom opens it up and I kind of crumple out. And they called the ambulance. The ambulance came and got me. And I was told not to move because I might have broken my neck. But it was a couple days before Christmas. And I had broken my jaw. And my jaw was wired shut all through Christmas and New Year's. There's nothing sadder than a kid drinking a Carnation Instant Breakfast while everyone else is having Christmas dinner.
But probably amusing.
No, not really.
Oh,
I did lose a lot of weight by the time they took the unwired my jaw. I think that they said I had lost like 30 pounds, and I was in sixth grade, so I didn't have 30 extra pounds to lose. But those are really fun episodes. I am halfway through the Lego episode, which is fascinating to me. I had no idea that they came so close to bankruptcy a couple of times. And I got caught up. Well, I didn't get caught up. I'm still like 3.5 months behind. But I watched a whole bunch of New Japan Pro Wrestling.
Cool.
And then I saw that Kenny Omega has a whole bunch of new cleaner shirts.
Boy, you'll never have to wash yours again.
And on ProWrestlingTees.com, they're having their 5th anniversary sale. So if you buy 5 t-shirts, you get 25% off. I'm just not going to wear anything but Kenny Omega cleaner shirts, am I?
No.
Comic-wise, I started reading the Garth Ennis Punisher Max Omnibus, and it does start with a Vietnam War story. It's Punisher Born, which I'd read before, but, oh, the printing on this is really nice. And I do have a little problem with the Punisher being in Vietnam, because if we go by the timeline, that means the Punisher's in his 70s now.
That's okay. Reed Richards was in World War II with the Thing.
Yeah, but they did a whole bunch of different times where he was rejuvenated.
And, you know, it was Superman met JFK, and then later Superboy met JFK, and then finally Super Baby met JFK. So it's just, you got to move with the times, Strode.
Well, remember now, the Marvel Universe is 17 years old.
Ooh, now I feel guilty.
But, yeah. And
it's only 17.
The new issue of Back Issue is about Jack Kirby. Well, not really. It's about the New Gods after Jack Kirby left. And there's some nice articles. I have not read the whole thing. And the last thing I did yesterday, it got to 100 degrees. 100 goddamn degrees. So rather than just sit and swelter, I decided to read to feel a little cooler. So I started reading Redbreast by Joe Nesbø, who is the number one Norwegian mystery writer. And I think it was about a year ago when they had a big stack of those at Half Price Book and Comic, and I grabbed a couple because they were, like, dollaring them out. You know, they had huge stacks of them. It's like, here, they're a dollar. Get rid of them. And Norwegian mysteries are much slower and more complicated than American mysteries. If you've read The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, they're a lot like that, where there's a lot of character stuff, a lot of background stuff. You learn about the entire lives of the characters. And I just started reading it, but it was nice to sit out and read a story that's set in a very snowy area when it's 100 degrees outside. So, and then it's Box Day next week. I took a look, and a whole bunch of the stuff that, Avatar was selling off dirt cheap about 9 months ago is finally going to get delivered. But I actually, the other thing I did, I kind of organized my reading piles here in the living room so that it didn't look like, you know, a bear lived here. So I have all of the free comics.
Are you saying you cleaned your own room?
I always clean my own room.
No wonder you hate yourself.
I hate myself with a passion of a thousand suns. But now I have all the free comic book days lined up. I have all the creepy and eeries lined up. And now I just need some time off to read them. That's not going to happen, is it, Joe?
Nope.
Okay. One other thing I'm geeking on. I am sleeping at the group home every night for the rest of this month. Now, Joe, ask me why I'm geeking on that.
No. I don't want to be an enabler.
First off, it means I don't have to pay for air conditioning. And I'm not joking. That will save me over $150 a month. Number two, I get paid $75 every time I do a sleep shift. So, more omnibuses!
I'm no lie.
But, yeah, they asked, and because of all the change going on at the group home, it's like, yeah, I'll take that shift. I'll take all those shifts. Fuck yeah.
Change.
It also makes it so it's a little easier for me to wake up in the morning. Because, you know, if I'm here at home and the alarm goes off, it's like, oh, I could just kind of, I'll hit
snooze. I may take a sick day today. I don't know.
No, I don't do that, but it's hit snooze. I hit snooze. Oh, crap, it's 7 o'clock. Now I got to hurry. At the group home, when my alarm goes off, there are residents who are right up and turning on lights and turning on the TV and wanting to talk. So I don't get to hit the snooze. My alarm goes off, it's like they're at the door waiting. And the second they hear my alarm, they're like, whoa, yay, we get to be up now. Well, believe it or not, kids, you've listened to us blather on about comic books for God knows how long, because I'll have to stitch two calls together. But it's over an hour and a half.
Cool.
And we actually talk comic books.
I know.
And as we say every week, the comic we like the least, we still like better than the comic that you like the most. Joe?
Bread is like the sun. It rises in the yeast and sets in the waste. Oh. I hit my music. Punk is on a roll. Punk is on a roll.
bitches!